Hello, everyone, and welcome to our final session of A New Republic of the Heart, A Guide to Being the Change for Real with Terry Patton. And I just would like to take a quick moment to just express my gratitude for this time with you and Terry and the whole team here. It's been a privilege and a blessing, and I was just sharing with Terry before we started that it feels good to be together. And even though we may not be side by side, that it's nice to know that our hearts are joined, and it makes me personally feel a little less alone in the world. So thank you to all of you, and we'll get started. And here's Terry.
Thanks so much, Sherry. Hi, everybody. Well, I'm feeling kind of bittersweet feeling. I'm really happy to be here with you all, and I'm kind of sad that our journey is coming to an end. That this is our last session. I've really enjoyed this whole process with you all. And as we begin this final session is the first one in a sense that is dedicated to the book as a whole, to integrating the total experience of reading the book and of this course as well. And so there's an opportunity in a way for us to, you know, in combining ourselves with the lessons in any particular session, in any particular chapter, it's as if we extend ourselves beyond the consensus trance, the consensus reality, the usual habits of our own minds, and we become more fully present to some hidden dimension of reality or truth. And in doing that, there's a particular yoga, a particular way of reshaping our consciousness to be with wholeness, to be with the integral view, to open into an evolutionary consciousness, to see with deep time eyes, to recognize each moment of experience as a moment of practice, to discover the way that no matter what we do, we're always living out a story, one or another, and that in some sense, our, you know, being suspended in the kind of babble of all the voices on TV and the internet and radio and all the different media that we're soaked in kind of rattles us out of a coherent story. And discovering something of our choice as story-making creatures. And then waking up to the fact that our personal practice is suspended in a collective process in which we are deepening our capacity to be friends, to be fellows, to be a we, to be an I with a thou, where we are less alone. That's what Sherry and I were appreciating together just before this began. And I want to express how much, you know, part of what I do in this process is not just to teach, but to get off the teaching pedestal and to be a human being with you, to show you, to lean toward showing you my own humanity and foibles. And my, it's so important that we not construe this matter of practice as if it is about personal perfection. It's so important that we recognize that the people who will rise to meet our epochal moment are us, you know, people just like us, idea of just taking a mugshot of yourself exactly as you are. These are the folks who are going to be the human, the highest human possibility coming forward. And so we've stretched into all these different places and really recognized our responsibility, that the future generations, the great-great-grandchildren's voices asking us, what would did we do? You know, we are, in a way that is both profoundly serious and deeply joyful and lighthearted, we are the ones. And here we are, you know, we've gone through a process that has put us in touch with so much and opened our cognitive capacities, you know, like the lines from that wonderful pop song, Happy by Pharrell Williams, you know, I'm a room without a roof, that opening up of our consciousness, both to the divine and to joy, but also to all kinds of different dimensions of insight. That's also where we meet and what we're about here. So calling all of that into the field, I'd like to begin, as I always do, with a guided process and a prayer. So, I invite you to find your way into a conscious posture, ideally with your spine straight and your feet planted, contact with your sits bones and your soles of your feet on the floor. And your head opened up without a roof to the light and freedom above. And breathe consciously, letting yourself feel every part of each breath. The beginning of the inhalation, the middle, the end. Way it turns and becomes an exhalation. Every part of the exhalation, just feeling it all. Letting yourself be fed by the life energy, the prana. Letting yourself surrender as you exhale, letting that life force pervade the whole body. Letting yourself feel how you are being lived by a greater life principle. You are being lived by the mystery. We don't know. We're not knowers. And yet we are able to notice so much. And there is a kind of ecstasy, an uncaused joy in being and being with this living moment, which is so profoundly deep. I am always only apprehending parts of this amazing holographic, ensouled, sacred, loving, blissful, heartbreaking, horrible, wondrous reality, unknowable, multidimensional. And notice feeling through your feet or your its bones down into the ground, down into the earth, from the floor to the earth, and across the surface of the earth. Noticing that we are all connected. Whatever continent we're on, it's contiguous under the ocean floor with the earth everyone else is grounding into. And we're all breathing. Or being breathed. And in some sense, we have a kind of fellowship with all the other breathing creatures, mammals and birds and amphibians and on. And even a more remote kinship with those that don't breathe as we do. Even the green vegetative beings, the plant spirits. This whole human and more than merely human family. And in the midst of this, we can turn to this deeper nature, the one who is breathing us and beating our hearts. As if we were separate, because as real as is our experience of being a me, a separate body mind, equally real is our relationship to this divine, groundless ground, this mystery. We can turn to you, you who are the source of grace, you who are my truest nature. You who are the mysterious source of the unintended breath, the unintended beats of the heart. You who are the life surging through us. You who are the source and essence of the beauty of the natural world. You who are the source and essence of all that is good and true and beautiful in our own being. Thank you. Please help us to relax and open and allow far more gratitude. Help us to enjoy the humor of the fact that no matter how grateful we feel, it's a fraction of what's appropriate. And help us, please, to deepen, to relate to this crazy moment in which we are all being given this Genjo koan, in which we all are asked for something more. Help us to open to your help. Please make it possible for us to relax out of this egoic sense of pressure and the heaviness of responsibility. Help us to become a conduit for your grace, that we can show up so that others are put in touch with the graceful nature of reality. Please help us find our way forward, growing always, so that everything that is best in us as individuals and as souls, as the spirit, that it all comes forward. Help us to love, help us to learn to love and to be brothers and sisters and friends and fellow practitioners at a whole new octave. Please help us to relax and trust the process. Help us to know, no matter what is to come, even if it is human extinction, even if it is our worst fears, that in a deeper sense, we can trust the process of our lives. We can trust you, you who are the life and light and freedom and joy and love, beauty, wonder. You've got this. Help us to be present as a kind of confidence and courage and generosity. And in the midst of that, a kind of humor and playfulness and creativity, that we may be generative in ways we are not used to being, beyond what we know. Please help us to suspend all the limitations we place on the wonder that you are. And in the presence of this sacredness, let's come back, open our eyes, come back into the space. And rejoin each other. You know, I really enjoy, my favorite part of these sessions are when you raise your hands and ask questions or make comments. I want to invite you to do so, especially if you haven't before. Thinking of it as an act of generosity, as a service to this whole gathering, to me, to the other students, to people who will listen or watch later. Well, while I'm waiting for some hands to go up, I think I'd like to bring something forward. I don't usually read during these sessions. Kind of don't like, you know, that it's not, I like to speak spontaneously, and so that's one of an extra reason why I usually don't read. But, you know, this, for this final session, I asked only one deepening question, but the deepening question was really asking you to feel into a sequence of 12 insights. I think I'd like to read them. I think they're rich. And what I'd like to invite you to do is to take these in and feel them and just let them, you know, combine yourself with them and breathe into them and then let them go and then inhabit the next one and the next one. And that might set the stage for the spontaneous conversations that I hope will follow soon. So these are 12 insights. One, among the deepest points of instruction from the world of organizational leadership is a simple principle. We have no control over the outcomes of our efforts, but we have total control of and responsibility for how we show up for the events of our lives. If we become radically faithful to this principle, we realize that we can for sure live our values. Then fear doesn't disappear, insecurity doesn't go away, but it becomes non-binding. Radical commitment becomes possible, and a certain kind of essential success, success in living our values, can be assured. Two, what most often determines life outcomes seem to be accidents or synchronicities, luck. The golfer Ben Hogan once said, "The more I practice, the luckier I get." So our commitment to change our consciousness, behavior, and relationships shows up in a life of practice. Its effects might create luck, personal and collective. Three, waking up and finding a way to be true, to consciously inhabit a new paradigm, one not supported by our objective cultural surround, is something that can only be done by trying. Now, it's not a problem if we fall short. It's inevitable. We can't do it perfectly. But as long as we keep making the attempt again and again, as many times as necessary, we're fine. Only in this way can a radically new pattern be set in motion. Four, an impressive body of scientific evidence is cited for the healing effects of prayer. These results are disputed in skeptical quarters, but regardless, they're an indisputably intriguing metaphor worth contemplating as a source of inspiration. Simple life forms like yeasts planted in petri dishes over which people prayed were found to grow significantly faster than those that didn't receive prayer. Might the whole human race learn to pray effectively for the health of the larger body of life of Gaia down to plankton and primordial life forms, and even including the atmosphere? Five, we do not know what the future will bring. Amazing disruptive emergences and black swan events are quite likely to reshape everything, radically expanding the vocabulary of experiences with which we can do our imagining and forecasting. Six, we live in and are adapted to a civilization far gone, in overshoot of our living planet's capacity, a terminally unsustainable civilizational system. We know no other way to live our lives except inside this system. We've learned only to walk and explore and navigate the multifarious sections and decks of this ship, this system, even though it may be the Titanic. This is where our life of practice has begun. Seven, here in this very situation, we have begun to have a forbidden conversation. We gather, choosing to see if it is possible to break through to being true, to obey a higher law, and to explore how. And yet, we are social creatures shaped by a culture that has mutated from original human ways, and much of how we live reflects our profoundly unlawful mutational context. And we choose to attempt to be true anyway. Eight, grace may be the only way to square this circle. Can we learn how to allow ourselves to be a channel, a vehicle, inspired, lived, and inhabited, empowered by a greater power, one capable of orchestrating newly emergent evolutionary leaps? Nine, we also inherit much wisdom. Humans have learned a lot about awakening, living with excellence, integrity, generous mutuality, courage, sincerity, and care. Intelligently, wisely, and wholesomely, as distinct from desperate, cynical, shrewd, and crafty. Countless eco-villages, sanghas, activist organizations, and other experiments are trying to live that out in one way or another. We have many fellow students of an emerging new pattern that no one can yet see in full. 10. Every one of our perspectives, ways of being, experiments, ideals, philosophies, methods, communities, and initiatives are profoundly true in certain ways and yet critically partial in others. Unless we are in conversation with a critical mass of other people and perspectives, we will be inherently blind to much of reality. 11. Our culture and habits, and perhaps even the morphogenetic fields, make possible an amazing range of patterns of communication. They define the ways we know how to engage each other. And even so, now something radically new is necessary. 12. In this course, we have taken a journey through the pages of a book in order to be able to feel all these facets of this moment here and now. And now we can turn to one another and we can ask, can the words we are capable of speaking be used now to transcend every conversation we have ever had? What might that look like? What can we say to each other? What can we hear and absorb? Okay, there's a lot to feel there. I see that Daniela has raised her hand. Hi, Daniela. Welcome.
Hi, hi. First of all, I'd like to thank you, Terry, and also everybody else that have contributed to my post on Facebook. I'd just like to share a little bit about my own journey through these course, because as you highlight very much, I'm a very kind of mental person. I do go to my mind to try to find answers and to find my way around it. And I think one of my big, the big takeaway from this course has been that I've understood that we are social creatures. We do need communities for our own survival. I mean, we do form communities, and we form communities, and the way that we do it is by recognizing those other people that have the same, that share the same beliefs and values. And then as one of the things that I understood was I have to be very clear when I talk about my shared values, because that's the way that I'm going to attract the people that will form my community. I'm talking about my community. But also, one of the things that I found out was that I had so much skepticism, and I was very cynical about what, as a community, we were capable of doing. And as the days and the weeks went by, and I'll went got to chair with my colleagues on my group and Mette and Stuart, then I realized, I mean, all that was coming out, all that was coming out because we had really deep conversations. And it's really kind of understanding where am I coming from on this conversation. If I am on that process of grieving because of what's happening in Venezuela, for example, I'm from Venezuela, or what is happening with in Britain with the Brexit, and obviously me being a foreigner when Brexit goes on, and then it's been very difficult situations. So where am I coming from? Am I grieving? And then when I go to communicate to others, obviously I'm not going to inspire much people if I'm coming from a very down, you know, negative point of view. So that was one thing that I thought it was brilliant. I said, okay, I need to have a clear distinction. What is my intention on this conversation? If I'm posting on Facebook, am I contributing to that separation? Mm-hmm. Right? Right. And then taking it from there, what's my next move? How do I actually show up mm-hmm. on all these situations?
Right.
So and it's been very positive for me. I mean, it will take a longer time than I expect to feel really positive. I went this weekend to Madrid, and there is a beautiful town outside Madrid, and there is this aqueduct that was built on the first century. And then it's just, you know, you get to see that that has been standing there for centuries and centuries and centuries, and life goes on. And then puts everything into perspective and really makes me think, you know, or makes me feel, now I'm trying to go to my feelings. And leaving all the thinking behind. Yes, it is possible, you know. It is possible. If I talked from my values and my beliefs, then I will be able to inspire people, to unite people, to bring people to this shared vision that I want to form with them. Hopefully, anyway.
Well, and if in some situation you were to attempt this and to not succeed, you would just learn how to do it better for a future attempt. You know, it isn't there. We can't fail is what, you know, we can only learn.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, I think I wrote this in the book. I certainly say it sometimes when I speak. It's really, really important for us to know that we don't have certain enough knowledge to be pessimistic. The future is emergent, and the whole history, even of biological evolution, but especially of cultural evolution, is one of emergence. You know, there have been emergent properties that have come into being. Well, like right from the beginning, that was the, you know, we have hydrogen, we have oxygen. Neither of them have any of the properties of water. The qualities of water are an emergent property. But historically, over time, you know, the emergence of life from dead matter, the emergence of consciousness and culture from seemingly vegetative life, the emergence, you know, even the emergence of sexual reproduction instead of, you know, there have been so many different moments when there have been miracles. You could have never predicted life from dead matter. You could have never predicted sexual reproduction from asexual reproduction of cells. And here we are at this critical moment in which the dominant life form on the planet is overshooting its carrying capacity and perhaps headed for a profound reckoning. And there will be no more qualities of emergence, no new miracles. We don't know enough to assert that there won't be miracles. And we definitely know enough to recognize that some of those miracles might come into being through us personally, but maybe even through our connection with each other, through this between point where our eyes meet, even if imperfectly over Zoom. there's a point there where a miracle can happen. So since our attitudes and assumptions can easily become self-fulfilling prophecies, I suddenly realize, oh my God, even though I thought I was just being realistic and my cynicism was coming from a real reality-based apprehension of the patterns at play, I have been drawn by my attempt to be reality-based into an orientation that could be morally indefensible. I might be creating what I fear just by being realistic and assuming that there won't be a miracle.
Totally. And one of the things that I realized as well is that I was feeling very inadequate for these conversations to do something, because I was trying to be positive, but I wasn't really feeling it.
Yeah. Well, that's why it's also really important in these conversations for us to just be transparent and to be real. And in the moment when you're not feeling it, it's okay that you're not feeling it. There's a paradox around this. There's a teaching I offer when I teach practice. I didn't get into it here in this course, but I call it fake it till you make it, in that we have to conform ourselves to a new pattern before it spontaneously expresses our inner experience. Our inner experience won't make us the best practitioner. We have to know better than our emotional patterns and choose to show up in a better way. We, in that sense, fake it till we make it. But it's also really, really critical that that we're radically honest, that we face what is, and that we don't hide from each other to any degree. And so there's a nakedness of a willingness to let it all hang out. And the fact that you're in a moment when you're not feeling very positive, and you would like to feel more positive, but it's just not coming. If you have a deep enough, intelligent enough spiritual friend, or a couple of them like your group has been, and you can show up as all of that, and let the best intelligence also be present. The reason you're thinking you want to be more positive is in some level you know that a more positive and creative relationship to experience would be more productive. You intuit a possibility and you want to find your way to it. And that's part of how you're feeling. That doesn't go away. And so you're not necessarily going to just be indulging the negativity. You're going to be making your humanity available for your friends. They'll be less alone because you're not pretending in any way, because you're really showing up. I think that there's that tenderness in this, in the place where we're all scared. And how could you be paying attention and not at moments be daunted and overwhelmed and scared? It's just the most human thing. I don't want to be with a bunch of people who are, I've had the insight and I'm super positive, and let's all be positive. Like, we're going to be skimming over the surface of all kinds of things. I want to be present with the totality of myself, and I want to feel all of you. I want to be in real relationship, in real community. And I hope that's what this process is making us all more capable of. Yeah. Thank you, Danny.
Thank you.
Yeah. Okay, let's see. I see two hands, but I haven't heard from, I've heard from Linda in some places, but not live here, I don't think. Please come on, Linda, welcome.
Hello. I've got, I hope this is appropriate for this class program. But in another program, another group I'm in doing your program, a few people have said to me, I don't know how to start being an activist. So I was thinking about it. And I've written some notes down of steps towards activism. These are my personal steps towards activism. It's for people who are coming to me and saying, I don't know where to start, and things like this. I just give you a background of me. I was an unemployed, long-term unemployed single parent with two children with different fathers, and I've never been married. And what that entails in society is quite challenging, because you get you get ostracized, you get prejudiced, you get talked about, you're poor because blah blah blah. But and I lived in an area with the highest unemployed place in England, in the northeast of England, where shipbuilding, iron and steel and chemical industries all disappeared with tens of thousands of people out of work. And I was bringing up my children in that. First of all, I did have, I always thought God couldn't possibly love me because I had children twice and I would be married, and I felt completely desolate from God until I read a passage in the Bible which said, and neither height nor depth nor principality, it was Romans 8, verse 31 to the end, neither height nor depth, nothing in the earth, nothing underneath, blah, blah, blah. Nothing in all creation will ever be able to separate me from the love of God in Christ Jesus. Because I thought I was desolate from God. I thought he wouldn't possibly love me. But the fact of this love, I realized that was for me and for every living thing on this planet. This love I felt, warts and all, was fantastic. You know, this revelation that I was loved with all this rubbish in my head. And I joined a movement, from a church movement, an ecumenical church movement. And we looked into issues of new unemployment and to value all people in or out of paid work. And these are just some of the things I was involved with. And I put steps towards activism. So it's the first step of activism is listening for me. It's listening, especially listening to the people who you don't particularly want to listen to, really. You know, people you don't usually listen to, because it's in the diversity of our listening that we learn a more holistic approach. And also, what we used to do is always listen to the national budget. And ask yourself, how does this budget affect the poorest in society? Always look at that at the budget. You know, if you're campaigning for social justice, economic justice and social justice, and remember that Gandhi said, we are only as rich as our poorest neighbour. And then we set up meetings. We linked into National Church Action on Poverty, because National Church Action on Poverty has governmental links. So the people in poverty could link into the government through the organisation, so we could get our issues across to the government. So I would advise people to find an organisation that is linked, has got a government link, and get into them. And one is a European-wide called Fourth World ADT, where poor people across Europe you know, meet with their national, with their national, with their national government and the European government, and they have poverty hearings, listening to people in poverty in both governments. And we set up meetings to hear the voices of the poor with Church Action on Poverty. We got every, we had 28 poverty hearings across the UK, and people in poverty only had the stage, and they were listening to local politicians, local church leaders, and local business people. And then it all accumulated to a national hearing in London, where we had national church leaders, national government people, and whatever, listening to in poverty. And so that's because people in poverty need their voices heard, because they're always told what to do, what to think, how to do this. You can't do this because you have to do this. They needed their voices heard. And when we had the poverty hearings, they give the poor people confidence that they could do something. They weren't just taking everything all the time. And we linked into Fourth World ADT, which was based in Brussels. And on the 17th of October, and this was in 1988, I've been on this for years, but we went to the World Day to Overcome Extreme Poverty. I attended a seminar in European Parliament in Brussels. And this coincided with the 50th anniversary of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. And the founder of ADT was a bloke called Father Joseph Wydlenski. And he's dead now, but in Brussels, there's a tombstone to him. And on his tombstone, this is really poignant to think about this, because he says, when I speak to people in extreme poverty, they tell me, it's not so much the lack of a job that despairs me, or the lack of bread on the table. It's in the contempt of my fellow citizens. It is this contempt that lies between despair and justice and basic human rights. And I think that's so true, because I've experienced it. And then another thing as well, prejudice is really a big thing as well, because prejudice can be the cause of poverty. And there's a great organization called National Coalition Building Institute, and they do interactive workshops to welcome diversity and eliminate prejudice. And they also do sessions on conflict resolution. And they bring diverse people together to break down misconceptions about each other. Like, for instance, the first exercise is standing up everybody from China. So everybody who looks Chinese doesn't stand up, and all these white people stand up because they were born in China. No, we can break down misconceptions. So there's lots of things to get into. And National Coalition Building Institute is in America. It started off in America. And also, I'm also not at the moment involved with, I'm retired, but at the moment I'm involved with setting up time banks. A time bank is a system where people pool their skills and they help each other for nothing. People in an organization, organizations can swap skills and they can help, you know, and individuals can swap skills. And we believe that the true wealth of any community does not rely on money, on the talents and resources of people. And there's loads of people out there who feel thrown on the scrap heap because there isn't a paid job around. Look, thousands of volunteers doing loads of work but don't get anything back for themselves. So for me, time banks is justice. And they can cross.
So it sounds, Linda, like what you're wanting us to get from your share isn't so much a detailed knowledge of each of these individual things as a sense of just how profoundly this new Republic of the Heart has already been coming into being, and how there are all kinds of opportunities to participate everywhere around us. Yes. And in fact, that you have a bunch of specific resources. I mean, there are a bunch of resources that I list at the end of the book. But I didn't include any of the ones you just mentioned, and they sound wonderful. So you're kind of helping us to feel and get right here and right now that even if we haven't been as active, we've been focused more on the inner work than the outer work, the opportunities for us to make a difference are right at hand. And And if somebody wants to reach out to you, you can help them find
Definitely.
Out some specific resources.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Definitely. Yeah. Beautiful. In fact, I've written a paper, what is 28 pages long, of it happens to be my experience because that's the experience I know, but it's things that have come up and how we've overcome them. How we've challenged the system and things like this, you know.
Is this something you've put on online somewhere?
I haven't. No.
But if you would like to send it to us, we can put it in the supplemental materials on this courses page.
Okay.
And you can post on the Facebook page. A link to it. What we'll do is once you send it to us, we'll post it and then we'll send you the link and then you can post that link on Facebook.
Yes.
The Facebook group will continue after the course is over.
Yeah. Personal perspective. Okay.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. No, I mean, you bring it to life by speaking it. Thank you. Beautiful. Ah. Annika, hi.
Oh. Oops. Hi. Okay. Oh, now I have three. I guess I'll pick this one. I was wondering. Oh, I have to put on my glasses. This is one of the questions you asked in one of our deepening practices. Why is trusting the process of your life so important for activists? And I was wondering if you'd share with us your answer to that question.
Mm. Oh, yeah. Oh my God. Well, you know, there are certain times in my life when it has seemed to me that everything was going wrong and that I couldn't trust the process of my life. I particularly remember when I was really young, I had always had the experience of, you know, I got very good grades in school and I was bright. So I became arrogant like millions of other young men. And so when I focused on personal growth movement and the ashram life and spiritual practice and meditation, I really felt that I was doing what was really important and that these people who are all focused on their careers and their credentials and their personal advancement and their bank accounts and their resumes were playing a small game and I was really seeing the big picture and I was doing the smart thing. And then at a certain point I realized that these were also important bottom lines and that I had kind of squandered a lot of my middle class advantages. And I had, if I wasn't going to be poverty stricken and oppressed and subject to the marginalization and contempt that Linda was just talking about, I was going to have to now earn it. You know, like I'd been raised middle class and I had gone to a good college, but I was now, you know, in my 30s without these advantages and that I had to build. And I got scared, you know, I had to really get at a deeper level that I had to trust the process of my life. And I've recently gone through another series of tests that are also, I think that financial tests can hit us at the deepest level because that's the survival is the bottom chakra. It's even below sexuality. Power is the third chakra. And you do tend to interpret your money stuff in terms of power. But where you feel your, you know, where you think you won't have what you need, that's the first chakra, and that's the most penetrating. And so when we feel threatened in any of those first three chakras, really, they're the ones. When we feel powerless, when we feel rejected and unloved, and when we feel like our survival is compromised, our ability to trust is compromised. We you know, how can I trust the process of my life? Everything is going wrong. I'm going to get screwed. The world is a machine, and it's a mean machine, and it's just going to mow me under. And it is mowing me under. And I'm waking up to the fact that I'm not immortal, and I'm realizing the way this is all going to end. I'm going to lose everything I love, and I'm going to be crushed, and, you know, that's where this is headed. And so the impulse to not trust is almost organismic. You are going to tend to not trust the process of your life, for sure. We just do. We are creatures, and something seems to be going wrong. We see, you know, this, because there, the fact of the matter is, life in this place is insecure. And in the play of things, we can have our times of, you know, the wheel of life turns. We have our times of success and things being great, and we also have the dark, you know, both are part of, inevitable part of our life experience. But in that place where I'm feeling like everything is going wrong, I lose the basis for my practice. I, ceasing to trust the process of my own life, alienates me from, I have to fundamentally know that there's a bigger lesson being taught, that these difficult experiences are part of how the school of life is instructing me, how I'm being like tempered, like steel being tempered in fire, that I am, that this is the cauldron out of which I am becoming someone new in a way that is actually part of the necessary curriculum of this life. And then I trust the process of my life. I realize this soul came into this place with capacities and challenges and certain lessons to learn. And what's happening right now is part of that process. And when I shift and I become attentive, then I'm willing to learn the lesson of whatever hardship is in front of me. And I'm respecting the kind of transformation it's working in my being. That changes everything. Activism from the place of victimization is inherently unattractive. It is bitter. It is angry, and it is not magnetic. And the more we source our activism in that place of distrust, the more ineffective we're always going to be. When we find our way back to a place that trusts the process, then suddenly, I mean, this has to do with the inherent dynamics of victim psychology. When I feel like a victim, my attention is on all the factors that pertain over which I have no control. When I shift out of a victim orientation, there may be, you know, 97% of everything affecting the situation I'm concerned about may be outside my control, but there's 3% inside my control. And my attention is on those, the ways in which there's a leverage point with the limited range of things I do have an ability to do something about. So that shift is like the difference between madness and sanity. It's the difference between being disempowered and being effective. It's a difference between being in hell almost and being a practitioner. It's a difference between being desperate and being involved in a creative process. And it is the hardest thing to do. That distance from orienting and in distrust and victimhood and orienting from a place of trust and willingness it's like paper thin, you know. It's like, you know, if I look at the piece of paper from this side, I see what's written on this side. And if I go over here, I see what's written on this side. And it's like, you know, the it's a few millimeters. You know, it's like a very subtle shift, but it makes all the difference. And that's, yeah, those are some things I can say to elaborate on that, on the way I relate to it. And then this didn't just happen that one time. I've had an experience recently where I made a big investment and I thought it would pay off quicker and my money's hanging out there. And I think it's important that everybody there's a little bit of a paradox here. It was sort of a ghost in the background of Linda's comments as well. We have a one of the reasons that people don't vote for their own best interests, and that they vote more conservatively, they vote for policies that are not generous to them, that people with lesser incomes will vote for more conservative representatives consistently across all cultures, is that we want to identify with the creative orientation, the winners. We want to be entrepreneurial. We want to be creative. We want to be generative. And we want to we identify with and we feel a connection with those who are making lemonade out of the lemons, those who are and therefore the political expressions on the left tend toward more complaint than is optimal. So we all have to realize that there's an inbuilt bias in all of us that has us, is either the really problematic contempt in that quote that Linda read is not the contempt that others inflict upon us, it's our self-contempt. It is the part of you that when you feel like you're under the wheel of an indifferent universe, you cease to honor the sacred occasion of your own existence and your potential creative contribution to a different future moment. And that self-contempt is absolute poison. And we are all subject to it. The fundamental spiritual task, it's in that place of despair, finding your way to a proactive orientation under difficult circumstances. That is the primal spiritual task, is going from that place of lack of faith to one of trust of the process. And it is the hardest thing to do, but once you get clear that that is within your power and no one can do it for you, and you recognize and you shoulder responsibility and a willingness and a choice to engage that spiritual task, you re-empower yourself regardless. So, yeah, that's a really important point. I'm glad you've brought it forward. Thank you, Annika. Oh, you're muted again, I think. Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, well, nobody else has raised their hand, so I think we will go into our breakout groups. What I hope you will do is let yourself be informed by those 12 insights I read at the beginning of our session, or early on at least. And I hope you will then have a closure conversation with some random people, and I'll participate in this. We'll go for about 15 minutes. We'll have a minute to get acquainted with each other. We'll have 3 minutes for each of the three of us to share. Then we'll have 3 minutes for all of us to just talk and debrief, and then that final countdown minute before we come back into the main room. And let's use that last minute, you know, clear it out so you can see your partners and use all four of those last minutes. And we have three kind of questions to respond to. You know, as this course completes, how have I changed? Let's speak to that. And then what am I curious about? Let's speak to that. And then what's inspiring to me? Let's speak to that. So how I've changed, what I'm curious about, what inspires me. And we'll each of us in turn, partners one, two, and three, do that. We might find ourselves just with one other person. Some of us might have somebody arrive a little late. That's the nature of breaking up into groups here. And we'll come together in just about 15 minutes after Sherry sets us in motion. Take her away, Sherry. Hi, everybody. I am back, and well, we're very close to 1:30, and I will need to end right at 1:30. But before I go, I want to tell you a little about what I hope many of you will decide to do in the time ahead, which is I want to offer a course that's not a course, a course that's not just, you know, our spiritual practice and our spiritual teachings tend to take up a certain space in our lives. And it, I think it's important for if we really get what time it is on the planet and we really are committed to being the change in a meaningful way, in a way we have to make a radical shift. And one of the metaphors I have for this was what I went through when I joined the ashram. You know, I use these three metaphors: going into the monastery, showing up at the recovery center to cure our addictions, but discovering there are only other addicts and that we have to create our own protocols, and showing up, getting your draft notice and showing up and reporting for duty in the revolution to the revolutionary cadre in the mountains that's really going to change things. In some sense, I want to make that real with a group of people. So I want to engage a social experiment as our advanced course. And part of it does have to take the form of a course that, you know, takes 3 or 4 hours a week of participation, you know, or more, because I want this to be a vehicle where we can do more. But we'll go through a certain curriculum. We'll have building blocks, and I'll be sending out an email about this within a week, and we'll have I'll offer a talk where I'll get into this in more detail. But I want everybody in this course, whether or not you show up for that, to be aware of how I want to frame this. I really want to break through the mode of, you know, what is this? Am I a pundit or an author or a teacher or a coach or a, you know, spiritual teacher? What am I? And then you become a student or a client or, you know, let's break that. Let's break that and become brothers and sisters in a new Republic of the Heart, a new pattern, a new stance, which is in some sense like a revolutionary army cadre in the mountains, you know, non-oppositional, non-violent, you know, but a revolution of love, but nonetheless radically committed. Also, people going through our own recovery, actually transforming ourselves and breaking our addictive pattern of living. And like a sacred matter, showing up in the monastery and going through the purification and transformation of our being to be made holy or sacred. That's what I want to do. I want to do that in a way that'll give you time to practice one-on-one with one other person, opportunities to be in small groups where a different kind of dynamic is possible and we learn different things and we meet more people and deepen our Sangha connections. And then also classes that I can teach and where we can have more random encounters like we just did. So that's what I'm hoping to do in the time ahead. Now, I want to return to this and to say thank you for taking this journey with me. And this is complete and full in its own right, whether you continue or not. I hope many of you will. But what we have shared is its own thing. And it's been enormously rewarding and joyful for me to share this experience with you. I'm really grateful. And I hope you've gotten a lot of benefit. I want to greet you here one last time. Maybe, Sherry, you can open everybody up and we can all look at the gallery view and turn on your video so I can see you. Thank you, guys. It's been a blessing to share all of this.
Yeah. Thank you, Terry. And
thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Terry.
Thank you.
Thank you, Terry.
Hi, Roger.
Thank you.
Namaste.
Thank you.
Love you.
Bye.
Wonderful. Thank you. Okay.
Yeah, thank you all.
Bye.
See you.
Bye.
Bye.